But the injuries will go away eventually. That's the good news. There is also bad news. Jackie was alone again. The voice from the loudspeaker came out as a whisper.
Ask your doctor why. Say it like that. Why? See if you can find out for us, okay? See if you can find out why.
The machines beeped. Jackie closed her eyes and returned to the relative normalcy of dreams. 33. Diane stood near Jackie. She had first gone to the accident site, but there wasn't much to see. Just some skid marks and an elaborate piece of 3D chalk art. Then she had a cab take her by a few of Josh's favorite hangouts, the video store, the Desert Flower Bowling Alley and Arcade Fun Complex, the sand wastes outside of town. But he hadn't been at any of them. He was probably, if he was not injured as well, but she couldn't bear to even think of that, at one of his father's several jobs, doing exactly what Diane didn't want him to do. There would be consequences when Josh came home tonight. There would be a reckoning. In the meantime, she needed to see how Jackie was doing. It had been Josh, not her, that had done this, but still Diane felt the guilt, personally, as though she herself had been at the wheel. Jackie had broken off the tip of the plastic knife the nurse had given her with her dinner, and was using the jagged edge to hack away at her arm cast. She had not seen Diane come in, but she had grown used to that. Most results have no visible causation. You wake up, and there's a friendly face above you. Or a part of you you had never seen and will never see again had been taken from you. Or a part of you you never had before, you now have. This is how hospitals work. Everything about Jackie looked sore to Diane. Her skin hung from her skull, her hair lay flat. Even her teeth looked loose. Her neck and face were still covered in angry purple blotches from the librarian's poison. What little strength Jackie had was being used to cut at her freshly cast cast. Diane had a cast when she was 12. She had fallen out of a tree and broken her leg. This is a common injury for children, as trees dislike young humans, and are notorious for picking them up and dropping them if they get too close. She had been grabbed by a ficus tree in her mom's office. Ficus trees are not tall trees, but they are muscular trees, stronger than they look. Diane had been able to break its grasp, but when she fell, she stumbled forward to the top of some steps, where she tumbled down to the lower floor, landing on that floor's emergency secret trap door, which had opened up onto the basement's jagged rock pile. She had, like most people, feared and loathed houseplants ever since.
"It itches like crazy, I know," she said.
"Not trying to scratch it. I'm looking to see if that paper is still there."
Jackie had gotten a good-sized hole in the cast.
"But now it also itches. Thanks."
"Ask your doctor if he is a cop. He is legally required to disclose this information if you ask," the loudspeaker said.
The nurse buzzed into the room.
"Oh, it looks like the cast didn't set right,"
the nurse sing-songed as Jackie openly hacked away, using the full motion of her arm to chisel at the plaster.
"We'll just have to reset that, won't we?"
Jackie put her swollen, sunken eye up to the hole in the cast. She couldn't see anything. She sawed at the frayed edge of the hole with the impotent edge of the knife.
"I think I almost got it."
"Ask your doctor if everyone is in your mind. Ask your doctor for tips for living in lucid dreams,"
the loudspeaker said.
"Reset the cast,"
the nurse said with a voice like a tolling church bell, her arm landing hard on Jackie's free hand.
"Reset the cast."
The nurse's pupils went vertical, and Jackie let go of the knife, relaxing her hand.
"I would rather have the pain than the fatigue," she said.
Her head rolled back, and her arms flopped open.
Just relax,
the nurse said, although she was no longer in the room.
You don't look well, Diane said. I don't feel well. How long are you supposed to stay here?
Dunno. Probably until tomorrow morning. Maybe tonight. Didn't even know this place was still open, did you?
Diane did not, but she was too distracted by her worry for Jackie and her frustration with Josh to care.
What happened?
Driving up Chuckwalla, leaving your house, I got to Lampasas, then all of a sudden I'm lying in this cot.
You didn't see the car that hit you?
Seeing Jackie's condition, Diane began to worry more about how Josh was doing. And why hadn't he stopped after the accident?
Nope.
I'm sorry about earlier. I think I upset you. I can't talk to younger people. I failed a lot with Josh.
Here's the problem, dude. You keep seeing me as a number, and I'm not that. Or not just that, or... Oh, I don't know. Jesus, everything hurts.
Jackie, I want to help you find the man from King City. There's a directness, a forcefulness to you that I just don't have. I need that. I need you to help me understand what Troy and Evan and all the rest want with Josh. I need to protect my son.
I'm tired, Diane.
Jackie wanted to yawn, but her jaw couldn't open wide enough.
He's my son, Jackie. You need to... I'm sorry. I can come back later.
No, in general. Tired. Broken.
She held up her cast, newly reset, although the nurse had never come back into the room.
When this comes off, I'll be holding a paper that says King City, and I'll keep on holding it for centuries, not growing old, not growing at all, still in Nightvale like I always have been. I'm never going to get my life back. I'm never going to get a life. I'll be 19-year-old Jackie Fierro, no purpose, one slip of paper, forever.
Her entire body was a vibration of pain and frustration. Diane was silent. The nurse came in, pacing back and forth at the foot of the bed. After a couple minutes, Jackie fell asleep, from the drugs and from the energy spent on her speech. The television turned itself on to talk about some local weather issues. The news anchors bantered back and forth about what weather they liked best. One said,
"Warm sunshine,"
while the other said, "Cool sunshine." They both laughed, and the ground shook a little bit.
"How's she doing, Diane?"
one anchor whispered to Diane.
"She's having a tough go of it, but she's going to be okay, I think."
"That's good to hear."
"It sure is, Tim," said the other anchor. "How are you, Diane? How's Josh doing?"
A picture of Josh appeared in the top left corner of the screen. In this picture, he was a French press coffee maker.
"That your son?"
Jackie managed. She was awake again, but barely.
"Yes."
Diane felt concern. "No. Not concern. Dread. No. Not dread. Terror."
"Looks just like you."
Saying this seemed to take a lot out of Jackie. She closed her eyes again.
"He's fine," Diane said to Trin. "He's fine,"
she said again, as if that made it more true than before.
"We heard he was on a search for his birth father," Tim said.
"Yes, exactly yes,"
Trin agreed.
"Josh and I have been talking about it. I don't want him looking for his father, but the important thing is..."
There was an orchestral fanfare from the TV cutting her off. An animated graphic flashed on the screen below Josh's photo. The graphic said, Teen Sleuth. The letters were red and yellow with a silver-lined bevel, and there was a grotesque digital arpeggio hammering home each letter as it appeared. Diane rubbed her forehead. Is this going out to everyone?
More news tonight on local teen Josh Creighton, the amateur sleuth in search of his birth father, Tim said.
We're getting reports now that the junior private eye has gone missing, Trin said.
For emphasis, the word missing appeared over Josh's photo.
What?
Diane stood up.
No, he's just driving around looking for his father. It's only been a couple hours.
For a report on this breaking story, Tim said, we go now to Ben, who is live at Night Vale General Hospital.
Yes, thank you, Tim, another voice said. I'm reporting live from just outside the ICU of NV General. She could hear Ben's voice both live outside the door and a few seconds later from the television. She felt like there was a gap where her chest had been.
Are you guys?
She turned. The nurse was gone. Jackie was asleep. Diane cried. As long as you have some control over your situation, her father used to tell her unhelpfully, there's no need to cry, only to take action. That statement made sense, right up until the tears came.
Jackie?
Diane's voice cracked.
Are you hearing this?
There was a knock at the door.
Can we come in, Diane?
Said the voice behind the door.
What's up?
Jackie said, her eyes still closed.
Can we come in, Diane?
The same voice repeated from the television.
The TV news, they say Josh has gone missing.
Jackie opened her eyes and forced her body into an upright position. Her face went pale with the effort and pain. Diane was still crying and did not cover her face. She let the tears fall openly. She thought of all the minutes, each individual minute, that she had left Josh home alone while she had chased useless ghosts all over town. If she had been home, he wouldn't be gone. The bin on the television screen was knocking on a hospital room door. Jackie turned her legs off the bed with slow, careful effort.
He's a teenager. Probably ran away for a little bit. Call him. Get in a cab. Get home. Call him.
He wouldn't have run away. He just took the car without telling me, that's all.
Sometimes kids run away. You can sit here watching the TV talk about it, or you can do something.
Diane's tears stopped. Her dry, red eyes looked into Jackie's tired, bruised eyes. She eased Jackie back into bed, gently helped her lie down, and pulled the cover up over her. She placed her hand on Jackie's forehead and stroked her temple. Jackie let her eyes close again.
You're right, Diane said,
trying to keep her panic from showing.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Jackie closed her eyes and was instantly asleep again. Diane opened the door and walked out into a completely empty hallway, hurrying toward the elevator. Behind her, on the TV, Ben stood in an identical hallway, frantically knocking on an identical door.
Ms. Creighton, a word about your missing son?
The reporter on the screen said into his microphone, pounding on the door.
Ms. Creighton, are you in there?
Diane stood in the elevator as the doors slid shut on an unpopulated and silent hallway. The voice of Night Vale. The hospital, which of course closed down years ago and is not being run by recognized medical professionals, or even by anyone who is or ever was alive. Do not go in there. Do not go. The press release for the new Ralph's Deli counter concluded. Well, I for one can't wait to get a sandwich there. And now a look at traffic. There is a man with a gray pinstripe suit covered in dirt. His hands are more dirty than the rest of him, but they are differently dirty. They are covered in rust-colored streaks. The last few days have been unclear to him. There was a time when his life had seemed like a hallway proceeding to a door. Now it was a garden littered with rocks. How did his hands get dirty? He couldn't remember. But the question made him drive faster in his nice car, even as he did not know why. He was in a desert. He kept looking at the mirror, which only showed him where he had already been. He wasn't sure why he was doing that either. Looking at the sky, he saw, much closer now, a planet of awesome size, lit by no sun. Or he didn't see it anymore. It was there, and it wasn't. It was some ratio of literal and metaphorical. He drove faster. How fast can a nice car drive? How much longer could he keep driving faster before he was driving the fastest? There seemed to be a city up ahead. There definitely was a city up ahead. It was a definite city. And at the speed he was going, it would not be up ahead much longer. He looked again in the mirror. Only a landscape unmarked by his passing. Only a road going back. Nothing he didn't already know. He knew nothing already. This has been Traffic. An update on the flamingo situation. The flamingos are extremely dangerous and appear to put you completely out of sync with reality if touched. You think it'll be fun being out of sync with reality? It won't be. You're wrong about that, person who I just imagined disagreeing with me. Old Woman Josie said that she and her non-angelic friends named Erica, who live with her, are trying to track down all the flamingos scattered all over Night Vale. She had put some in the pawn shop earlier, but she has been unable to reach pawn shop owner Jackie Fierro. Since the pawn shop's doors are removed and buried whenever the pawn shop is closed, Josie and her not-at-all-heavenly friends were able to easily walk in and reclaim the flamingos, even with Jackie not around. Meanwhile, the city council announced that the flamingos sure seem like a serious situation, and probably they'd look into it someday. Yeah, definitely, they said in a monotone unison. Swarming out of the shadows of the council chambers with eyes like flames and mouths like flames and bodies like flames. Basically, they were just giant flames. We'll get right on that. Haha, sure. It's a big thing for us and we're taking it super seriously. It's just that, we hate to bring this up, but today is the day where a human sacrifice is made in our honor. And while the flamingo situation seems dire, it would be super dire to interrupt something so important as the sacrifice to the city council. So, yeah. The monotone univoice concluded. We will update you with more news about the flamingo situation as we know things and feel compelled to speak those things aloud. Sheila, the woman who marks people down on her clipboard at the Moonlight All Night, came by the studio. She is now sitting outside my booth, looking at nothing in particular, and doodling listlessly on her clipboard. I asked her why she came here. I just needed to do something different, she said. Even one different thing will end the cycle I'm in. I can't go back through my life again. I don't even remember what a life is like. I only remember a series of scripted events. I don't remember ever coming to this station before, though. I think maybe if I just quietly sit here long enough, not doing what I'm supposed to do, then finally I will be free. I told her I'm fine with her sitting there. I'm here to serve the community. That's what I said. Oh boy, she must really be in a state. Here I've been talking about her for a whole minute and she hasn't looked up once. Sheila? Sheila? Okay. Sorry, listeners. I need to go make sure she's all right. I take you now to the sound of a human stomach digesting, heavily amplified and electronically distorted. 34. Diane stood in Josh's empty room, dialing again. Each time it went straight to voicemail. She checked her texts, reading his last text. Good, be home later, again and again. She called the sheriff's secret police. She called Josh's friends. She called Josh again. She called the comic book and video stores again. She called Josh again. She called Josh again. He had to have his phone with him. It was illegal for any person to not carry at all times some sort of device by which the world government could track their location. Most people opted for a cell phone because it could also do useful things like make phone calls and attract birds. A few holdouts still preferred the old tracking collars, bulky and impossible to take off, though they were. She rifled through the papers on Josh's desk, and the ones shoved in his books. She found all kinds of sketches and doodles and homework worksheets. She pulled open his drawers, finding his illicit writing utensils. She didn't care. He was a teenager. What are you going to do, stop a kid from writing because it's illegal? Some cockroaches with corporate logos on them, and a partial tarot deck. She confiscated the tarot deck, making a mental note to lecture him about that once he was safely home. He would be safely home soon, she was sure, but also keeping it for her own use later. There was nothing from Josh, and no one else she had gotten hold of knew where he was. They all offered their heartfelt condolences. She could taste her worry about Josh as an actual taste on her tongue, and it tasted like rotten citrus. Diane tried texting him again. When she pressed her thumb to send, she felt a familiar sharp pain. She did it again. She felt it again. Her phone's touch screen grew cloudy with smudged blood. He was unavailable or, even worse, forbidden to call by civil ordinance. She let out a high-pitched yelp of anger and kicked the open desk drawer shut. The framed movie poster above Josh's desk of Lee Marvin in Cat Blue rattled. She sat on the corner of his bed, put her head in her hands, and let out a sob that swelled her face and burned her eyes. She slid down the side of the bed, her butt thudding to the floor. She intentionally inhaled and exhaled toward the sky. The ceiling fan blew her breath back at her. From this vantage point, she could see under the desk. There was a pale fluttering, like a white moth. Josh? She asked hopefully, foolishly. He had never been a moth before, but he liked to try out new forms. She reached under the desk and felt something light, thin, small. Not a moth. Paper? Paper. Before she pulled it out and held it up to her face, she knew what it said. King City. Over and over, as though the writer was unable to write any other words. It was not the same as the paper the man in the tan jacket had given her. It was lighter, cheaper stock. The lettering was different, too. It was shakier. The curves of the G and the C were bulbous and crooked, written in thin pen. The words on the paper Evan had told her to pass on to Josh was written in a thick, assured pencil. She reopened the desk drawer, She ran her hand through the illegal writing utensils and found a pen that matched the color and gauge of the writing in her hand. How did he know about King City? Diane pulled her purse off her shoulder and threw it against the wall. She smacked the desktop with her palms. She cursed. She stomped. Nothing helped. She looked at her purse, lying open near the doorway. She remembered the paper Evan had given her. She had gone to throw it away behind the moonlight all night, but put it in her purse after seeing Troy. She rifled through the purse, and just like her car keys, the paper was not there. No, Diane said again and again on the floor of Josh's empty room. King City, the paper said again and again in Jackie's hand, and probably now in Josh's hand as well. Diane grabbed her phone and tried calling him one more time. She could feel the phone burning her ear. She could smell it burning her hair. She let it ring and ring until the pain was searing, until her hair caught on fire, until she could not physically hold the phone to her head a moment longer, and then she let it ring a moment past that. 35. Jackie leaned back, her feet on the counter. It was the first time she had been in the pawn shop in days. When she left the hospital, she wasn't sure where else to go. She didn't love being at the shop, but it was home, and she just wanted to go home. In most ways, it felt like it always did. But now her entire body hurt, and she knew the paper was curled up in her cast, like the hidden centipede nests that sometimes appear overnight in people's beds. The leaning, her usual position at the counter, was killing her back, and so she got off the stool and stood. She had never done that before. She looked out the window where, not that long ago, she had watched a man in a tan jacket run away. There were bubbles of light, low to the ground, out in the desert, and a tall building, and voices. As she watched, more buildings appeared. A forest of tall buildings, all glowing, their bulk wisping away to nothing as they approached the sand below them. Bubbles of light, and voices. A crowd of voices. It was King City. She knew it now. Somehow, from all this distance, the city was calling to her. She spat at the lights, but only hit her window. She watched her spit roll down the glass and felt, for the first time in her short and long life, absolute despair. All of her and Diane's investigations had not gotten rid of the paper, or allowed her to write down any words but King City, or gotten rid of the visions out in the desert. Her life wasn't what it had been, and it never would be again. For a brief moment, spending time with Diane as an equal, she had wanted to grow older. But that feeling was gone. Her body ached. First the librarian poison, and then the accident, and then whatever they had done to her in the hospital. Her body no longer felt young. All of her energy had been robbed from her. She felt old, looked young, was neither. The bell on the door rang. "We're not open," she said. "I'm sorry, I know it says we're open, but we're not really." No answer. She looked up and saw a woman in a business suit. The woman looked at Jackie but did not seem to see her. She was holding a small cardboard box in one hand and a large metal hoe in the other. The wedge of the hoe had a dark brown stain with a few misshapen hairy lumps sticking out from it. "Like I said," Jackie said, "closed." The woman set both items on the counter and began to wash her hands, chanting to herself as she did.
"Hey, I'm sorry, man. I can't take this. I can't do that anymore."
The visitor finished washing her hands. She was shaking and her hair was over her face. She would not look down at the box or at Jackie.
"Take your things and go, goddammit."
The woman did not go. She stood there like she was waiting to be dismissed. Jackie sighed. Her back hurt so much, and her hand itched madly in the cast. She had never felt so distant from herself.
"All right. I can't actually give you a ticket because it would just say King City over and over. I won't pay you anything. You won't die for any period of time, and I won't put it out for sale. But just sign here and you can go, okay?"
The woman signed the name Catherine to the ticket, put the pen down, and asked in a small, shaken voice,
"Is it over now?"
Jackie nodded. Catherine shuddered and walked out, upright and smiling, a different woman than had entered the shop. Jackie took the hoe and, with her good arm, awkwardly leaned it on the trash can next to her. She opened the box. Inside was the mangled body of a tarantula. It had been hacked over and over until most of its body had detached from itself, a jigsaw puzzle way past solving. She looked out the door and watched the lights of Catherine's car diminish into the highway distance. Jackie tossed the box in the trash, wincing as she did. The lights and voices out in the desert were gone. She sat alone in the dark pawn shop, looking at nothing in particular, thinking about nothing in particular. Somewhere, Catherine felt better. Nowhere, the tarantula felt nothing at all.
36. Diane bought a bus ticket to King City. It was as easy as that. The bus left at 7 o'clock a.m. She brought a small suitcase and a little bit of cash. She boarded the bus, which was a standard bus, flint gray with a long rectangular body, two flat front windows, 7 wheels, and several narrow viewing slots along the sides, so that the passengers could have a heavily obstructed view of the outside world. The bus pulled out of the station and onto the highway. Diane tried texting and calling Josh again. It was painful, emotionally and physically, to do so, but she kept doing it anyway. She wished Jackie were with her. It would be easier with another person on her side, someone so steady and fearless, as young as she was. But Jackie was on her own painful journey, and Diane would have to do this alone. The man sitting across the aisle from her was asleep moments into the ride. He was wearing overalls and a wooden hat. He had only one arm, which he kept folded behind his head. There was a tattoo along his tricep of a head of Boston lettuce crawling with ants. From between the broad leaves came 2 bare human legs, and below it all was a banner that read, "Corazon." She listened to him breathe. His inhale was long and pinched. A thread of breath pulled taut into his sinuses. His exhale began with a muffled pop, like the sound of a freezer door opening, and spiraled out to a wheeze. Diane closed her eyes. She tried to breathe synchronously with the man across the aisle. She put one arm behind her head and breathed intentionally. Yesterday, she had called the sheriff's secret police and reported her car and her son missing. When asked for a description of the car, she described colors and shapes. This matched the police's understanding of what a missing burgundy Ford hatchback looked like. When asked for a description of Josh, she cried. This matched their understanding of what a missing teenage son looked like. The secret police, who were standing in Diane's doorway only seconds after she had said, "Secret Police," into the poorly hidden microphone mounted above her refrigerator, had said they would look for him. "We're looking for him now," they had said, standing completely still. A helicopter had flown over the house, but this had been unrelated. Helicopters were almost always flying over the house. "Helicopters keep us free," the house had thought. "Helicopters keep us free," the billboards all over town said. "Helicopters keep us free," the sheriff's secret police had said to Diane then, in her kitchen, and also during all routine traffic stops, and at community events, and through bullhorns mounted atop cruisers cruising through quiet neighborhoods on Sunday mornings. She had shown the police the paper with "King City" written all over it. One of the officers held the paper to his face and then showed it to another officer, who had smelled it and then dropped it to the floor, where another officer had belly-crawled by quickly with a clear plastic bag and thick rubber gloves. The crawling officer had grabbed the paper with the gloved hand, put it in the plastic bag, sealed it, and written "Nope" on the bag in black marker. The officer had belly-crawled away, leaving the bag behind. It didn't look like they were going to help her at all. The next day, she had gotten up early and taken a taxi to the bus station. As the bus drove on, she tried to sleep, but could not. She urged herself to hold still, but would eventually feel an itch on her side and would have to start over. The bus kept its lateral trajectory, which felt flat and straight. Every time she squinted out her viewing slot, she saw desert sameness. Her phone's battery was almost dead, even though she had charged it before leaving the house. Anyway, it had no signal to call out or in. She wished she had brought a municipally approved book to read, like Vacation by Deb Olin Unferth, or The Complete Plays and Verse of Kurt Russell. The man across the aisle never moved. His legato breaths stayed constant, a windy metronome. The bus had been in motion, non-stop, for several hours, and she had not been able to sleep or read or use her phone. There was no visual complexity to the passing scenery or visceral texture to the drive. She was thankful for the man with the lettuce tattoo. She loved him, this man. He was, aesthetically and aurally, perfect. She loved him the way one loves an old bridge, or a wool sweater, or the sound of a growing tulip. As she stared at him, the bus slowed and veered right. King City, at last. She had only a vague plan for when she arrived. She would first try to find their secret police department, wherever it was hidden. Perhaps there was a radio host, some version of a Cecil Palmer for King City, California. She could contact that person and ask for them to put out a call for Josh, the way Cecil generously announced over the radio the location and personal details of Nightvale citizens, without even being asked at all. The bus came to a stop at a traffic light. They were clearly out on the edge of town. There was a used car lot. The bus turned, and her viewing slot showed her an old house that looked similar to Josie's. Diane leaned into the aisle and looked out the front of the bus at a familiar low skyline. The library, the rec center, the pink berry, the distant brown stone spire. She walked to the front of the bus and leaned over the white line, careful to keep her feet behind it. "Is this Nightvale?" Diane asked. "It is," said the driver. Her name tag said Mab.
"But this was the King City bus."
"Right." Mab's sunglasses hid any feelings she might be having about the questions.
"But we never stopped or turned."
"Not many turns on that road."
They passed the antiques mall.
Today the antiques in the window were playful, jumping over each other and wrestling. Diane stumbled over the white line as the bus turned onto Somerset.
"Feet behind the line, please."
She obeyed.
"I don't understand. Why did we never stop in King City?"
Mab eased the bus to a stop at the downtown bus, train, paddleboat terminal. She turned and pulled off her sunglasses. Her feelings about Diane's questions still weren't clear because she had no eyes.
"My bus started in King City. Why would I stop in King City?"
"I'm sorry."
"You got on the bus in King City. It is a nonstop bus from King City to Night Vale. No turns, like you said."
"Okay. I'm sorry."
Diane turned toward the other passengers, hoping someone would join her confusion or plead her case. The bus had started in Night Vale. It had, right? But all of the seats were empty. No one on board but her and the driver. Not even the driver now. Mab was standing outside, sunglasses back on, smoking a clove cigarette. Diane walked back to her seat and grabbed her suitcase. Before leaving, she knelt down and put her hand to the seat directly across the aisle from hers, where the man had been. It was cold. She got off the bus. She called Steve Carlsberg, who had a car. Steve was happy to take Diane to King City. He was excited to go. He complained about not having received anything from a man in a tan jacket and agreed to skip work. He would pick her up from the bus station and they would leave this very morning.
"Morning?" she said. "What time is it?"
8 o'clock. "Good and early start. Oh, this will be fun," Steve said.
She could hear the dinging of his car. He was already on his way. She hung up and checked the time. Her bus had left at 7 and had been on the road for at least 6 hours. It was 8:03 a.m. Mab pinched out her cigarette and swallowed it. She climbed back into her bus, pulled the doors shut, and drove away. Diane waited. She bought a coffee and a banana in the station and waited. She bought another coffee and waited. She stared at the arrival and departure screens and waited. She checked the time and waited. It was 9:34. She called Steve.
"Where are you? Is everything okay?"
"What do you mean, Diane?"
"I thought you were coming to pick me up and we were going to drive to King City."
"Drive to King City? Gosh, I'd love to. That sounds so exciting. When did you want to go?"
"As soon as you can."
"Listen, I'll take the rest of the day off. Where are you?"
"I'm at the bus station downtown."
"Okie doke."
Diane waited. 11:15 a.m.
"Steve, where are you?"
"Work. Why? What's up?"
Diane called a cab and asked the driver to take her to the airport. Yesterday, she had called her insurance company. She was hoping she could get a replacement car to drive to King City. The insurance company had asked her where her car was.
"I don't know."
"If you do not know where your current car is, how can we replace it?"
"It was stolen."
"So you don't see your car right now?"
"No."
"If you cannot see a thing, how can you be sure it exists at all? Are you familiar with Schrödinger's cat?"
Diane had hung up and called back, hoping for a different agent.
"You did not answer our question."
There had been only one ring, and the voice had immediately started in.
"We cannot replace a vehicle that does not exist."
"You have my VIN number and all of the pertinent information in your system."
"This? This is just ones and zeros. This is just lights flashing various colors and shapes. There is nothing physical or real about data. Here, I just changed your middle name to 5 F's in a row. Diane F. Creighton. It says right here on my screen, Diane F. Creighton. Do you accept that is your name because it is in our quote system?"
No.
No, you do not. Just as we would not accept that a vehicle exists simply because there is a number here in my quote system.
Shut up and listen.
She had shouted this. She wasn't sure she had ever shouted on the phone before.
My son is missing. My car is missing. I need to find him, and I need a car to do that. I have no time for your absurd logic.
Absurd logic is an oxymoron.
Absurd logic!
She had screamed into the phone.
Hiss.
The representative had replied.
You are an insurance company. I pay you to replace or repair my vehicle, or compensate me in the event that something happens to my vehicle. Something has happened to my vehicle.
No response.
I need a car because I need my son. Can you understand me? Can you sympathize here? Just a small amount of compassion to get this done?
Another long silence.
Are you?
She had said.
Yes. We're still here.
Have you?
Quiet, Diane. We heard you. We are sorry. Give us a moment. This is difficult for us. Hearing that a customer has a missing child hurts us deeply. Please give us some space.
Diane held back another eruption. Of the stages of grief, Diane had already gone through denial, sadness, and despair. Now she had been on the verge of the final step. Vengeance. The voice on the other end, clearly crying, had said,
"We'll see what we can do. It will take no more than 2 weeks."
2 weeks?
This is hard on us, too,
the representative had sobbed. Diane had hung up. The cab pulled up to the airport. Nightvale Airport is not big. Most of the planes are propeller planes, private planes, secret military drones, and government planes that are used to make chemtrails. But she found a commuter airline to fly her from Nightvale to King City. She was one of 4 people on board the 20-seat plane. She had never flown before, having never left Nightvale. She wasn't sure whether she was a nervous flyer or not, but the plane certainly felt small and fragile. It took off with a whirring shudder, and she felt dizzy as it rose through the clouds. She leaned her head against the window, but the rough ride caused her to bump her head against the hard plastic, making it impossible to sleep. So, she watched the red flatness of the desert pass slowly below them. She looked out to the horizon, wondering if she could ever believe in mountains again, having seen this flatness from above, and whether anyone would ever learn what clouds were made of. It was probably best we never know. She glanced about at her fellow travelers, finding it interesting that they were all wearing blue earphones and horn-rim glasses. They were most likely part of a vague, yet menacing government agency. Diane wasn't sure if they were following her, or the pilot, or what, but they looked bored and tired. After a 2-hour flight, the plane touched down. It had been a long and expensive day, and she had only enough money for a few more cab rides in King City. As the plane taxied to the gate, which was simply a wood stepladder on the tarmac near the terminal, Diane watched the world scroll from right to left across her window. Behind the airport, she could see a small city watched over by a distant brown stone spire.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached our final destination of Nightvale. Please remain seated until we come to a complete stop and the captain turns on the free will sign.
Diane punched the window, crying, "No! No!" Her voice cracking and eyes watering. She couldn't help it. She turned to look around the cabin, conscious of the scene she was causing. There were 12 other passengers on the plane. They all wore baseball caps and knit shirts. They were sitting together in the back rows, not showing any awareness at all of her outburst.
"Thank you for flying with us," said the pilot, as Diane dragged her suitcase off the plane.
She put down the suitcase and sat on it, right there on the tarmac, having no idea at all what she should do next. The Voice of Night Vale.
At a loss for words, at a profit for hand gestures, and more or less break even on eyebrow movements.
Night Vale Auto Insurance Company announced today that because of rising costs, they will no longer offer replacements, repairs, or compensation for any accidents involving automobiles.
It's really expensive to fix or replace a car, said Bob Sturm, vice president of finance. I mean, think about how many accidents there are. Those add up. How are we supposed to pay for all of that?
When asked if they will lower premiums since they are no longer covering any form of repair, Sturm said no, but they will send customers kindly worded sympathy cards. And customers who have been in an accident can come by any one of their 10 area locations for a hug and an it'll be okay pat on the shoulder. Sturm concluded the announcement by coughing up a little bit of blood and laughing. And now an update on Sheila down at the Moonlight All Night, with her clipboard and pen, living her life over and over in a sad, empty reenactment of what was once an organic experience. She said that the loop finally seems to be broken, and that things are looking up. I asked her if it wasn't then maybe time to leave the studio and return to her life. But she said she couldn't imagine doing that. Not anymore. So I offered to let her become a station intern instead. Isn't that just the best? I gave her the intern tunic and told her about the usual duties. Mimeographs, making coffee, editing my slash fiction. I think she'll do just a great job, and she'll learn a lot while working here. I'm pretty sure that all of our interns have gone on to do great things with their lives. I haven't followed up with any of them or even thought about it for very long, but I'm sure they are all better off for having done their internship here. Sheila is so happy. She took the clipboard she had once used to mark down people at the Moonlight All Night and broke it over her knee. Which is a waste, Sheila. Do you think community radio stations have the kind of budgets that allow us to just waste clipboards like that? Don't do that again, Sheila. Moving on. Many of you have written to the station asking for more information about our annual fund drive, which was held 2 months back. It seems that the tote bags and mugs and DVD sets of Mad About You seasons 2 and 5 have still not arrived for many donors. We here at Night Vale Community Radio apologize for the delay. Please know that all donor rewards have been mailed out, were mailed out weeks ago. But, as we all know, time is weird here in our beautiful community. As a result, those weeks may have been experienced by you as mere seconds, and the delivery would seem instantaneous. Or those weeks may be experienced by you as millennia, and you will be a terrible, vacant, ancient form of yourself by the time you receive your reward. These possibilities, and all other possibilities, remain possible. Please know that our station exists because of donors like you. It also exists because a long and terribly improbable series of galactic events over the course of billions of years conspired to bring us to this very moment in our station's existence. And we thank you for your support. Again, we apologize for the delay in receiving your items, and also for the absurdity of time. Next on our program, I will describe a boring photo in 1,000 slow, interminable words. 37. Jackie knocked on her mother's door. After a moment, it opened.
Hello, dear. Come in.
Her mother turned and walked back to the kitchen, and Jackie limped after her. she tenderly sat down across from the woman she did not recognize.
Mom, she tried calling her. Mom, it's been a rough couple days. Let's start there. I can't work anymore, and if I'm not working, then I'm not sure who I am. Maybe that's not healthy, probably isn't. But it's all I've done as far back as I can remember, which, okay, memory. Want to talk about that in a moment. But I've been trying to figure all this out. Feels like running up a slide while other people are trying to slide down it.
Jackie picked up one of the perfect wax-looking apples. She sniffed it. It was real.
I've been spending some time lately with Diane Creighton. Not like that, but... You know Diane? Does stuff with the PTA? Works at that office, no one is sure what they do? Anyway, Diane and I got into this thing where we didn't like each other. But I think I was wrong about that. I think I'm wrong about a lot of things. My car got hit, and the other person just drove away, and I think that other person was Diane's kid, who's missing now, and I sympathize with him. I do. But my body feels as wrecked as my car. I can't move right, and I feel slow and tired. I understand that kid. Sometimes you need to run away. I feel bad because I said that to Diane, but it's true. I'm sorry, Mom. You probably feel different, but I think maybe he's right to leave. Diane cares so much for him. It's not other people that hurt us, but what we feel about them.
Her mother didn't respond. She wasn't even looking at Jackie. Her eyes rested on the ceiling.
It got me thinking about what you said to me, and I don't. I don't remember my childhood. I don't think I've ever been in this house. I don't know who you are. I don't remember being any other age than what I am now, and I don't remember doing anything but what I've been doing. I'm not normal, am I? I mean, I understand that many things in Night Vale aren't what they are in other places, but even for Night Vale, I don't think I'm normal.
Her mother took the apple from her and put it back in the bowl. She stood.
Let's step out in the backyard, shall we?
They did. Her mother put a hand on her arm.
Jackie, what I want you to understand about both me and Diane is this. It's not easy raising a child in Night Vale. Things go strange often. There are literal monsters here. Most towns don't have literal monsters, I think, but we do. You were my baby, but babies become children, and they go to elementary schools that indoctrinate them on how to overthrow governments, and they get interested in boys and girls, or they don't, and anyway they change. They go to high schools, where they learn dangerous things. They grow into adults and become dangerous things. But none of that is as difficult as the main thing. We all know it, but most of you don't spend any time thinking about the consequences of it. Time doesn't work in Night Vale. You were a child, and then you were a teenager, and then you were old enough that I thought, it might be time for you to run my pawn shop for me. Just some days, just sometimes. I could use the time off, after running it for years while also raising a child on my own. I taught you how pawning an item works. Pawn shops in Night Vale work like this, I said. I showed you the hand washing and the chanting and the dying for a little while and how to write out a ticket. I showed you how to bury the doors at night so they wouldn't get stolen. I showed you this. And then you started running the shop on your own. And I was so proud. But time doesn't work in Night Vale. And so one day I woke up to find you had run that shop for decades, centuries even. I'm not sure. You held on to the pawn shop but let go of me. I happened to offer $11 to the first customer we helped together, and in the years of being 19, you forgot that moment between us and only retained the offer of $11 as a meaningless, unchangeable ritual.
People in town couldn't remember a time when you weren't the one running the store. But I could, because from my point of view, you've only been running it a couple months. It's all so fresh for me. The course of your